It's Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out why teacher strikes seem to be getting more frequent and what impact those strikes are having.
First, fitness culture has always existed, taking on different forms as the years go by. Aerobics, the birth of the mega gym, yoga, the list goes on.
But fitness culture has taken on a new form in our age of smartphones and technology. There are apps for workout plans to get you in shape, social media influencers promoting their own training programs and gear, and people all over the internet sharing their own workout progress.
There's a lot of information out there, a lot of pictures of other people's bodies, and a lot of suggestions for your own fitness routine. But is any of it actually helping us get healthier?
Christy Greenleaf is a kinesiology professor in the Exercise Science and Health Promotion Unit at UW-Milwaukee. She's also the co-director of UWM's Body Weight and Shape Research Lab. Christy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I think this is a very timely conversation to have.
Yeah, are you seeing this? Are you seeing our apps and our social media changing the way people think of exercise?
Yeah, I think it just provides easier access to social comparison. So I think people have always engaged in, you know, comparing themselves to others in whatever area of success we sort of think of as important. And certainly having a body shape that approximates sort of the social ideal has a lot of value or carries a lot of value. And so I think social media in particular allows people sort of easy access to that social comparison.
And social comparisons have always been kind of a point of focus for whether it be gyms or other activities. But I'm wondering, Christy, do you see this being a whole lot more personal in the age of social media?
Yeah, it's easier, I think, to sort of specify or focus in on maybe what is most relevant for you as an individual with social media and its sort of flexible format where you can easily search out, you know, a lot of different information pretty quickly. And so I think, you know, in the past, people might have relied on mass media, so maybe print media and from magazines or other forms of media. And now, yeah, I think you're right. It is a little more personalized and individualized.
Now, one of the big questions here is, okay, if we see online, if I see my friend's swimming time or their before and after fitness picture where they've done great, does that motivate me or does that discourage me because I haven't done anything that good?
Well, it's not a fun answer, but the answer is it depends. So some folks will engage in what's called upward social comparison. So I might seek out information for someone who's achieved what I desire to achieve, whether it's a certain physique or a particular accomplishment, and I might find that motivating. So it might give me information, or I might seek out information about how I can also, you know, have that accomplishment. Others might engage in downward social comparison. They might look for examples or individuals of folks who seem maybe less successful in body shape or physique or athletic accomplishment. It might take some satisfaction in knowing they're at least better off than some other person or some other group. And how that impacts someone's motivation can really depend on a whole host of factors. Oftentimes, self-efficacy plays a role. So the belief you have in your ability to successfully complete a particular task. And so if you're feeling motivated and you feel competent, like you have the skills, the resources, or the abilities to also achieve that goal or that desired outcome, that can sometimes be positive for folks in terms of motivating engagement in physical activity.
I'm also curious, it's one thing when a friend posts something on Facebook that says, hey, I just went on a 5-mile run and here's the route that I took via Map My Run or whatever the app is. It seems like it's another thing altogether when you've got someone on Instagram, an influencer, we've seen the growth of influencers recently, telling you, hey, you got to try this new exercise fad. Hey, I just lost 50 pounds doing this thing. How does the message change and how does the pressure and motivation change when we're talking about a friend giving us this information versus maybe someone we don't know?
Sure, that's a really great sort of point to consider. Sometimes we might think about what's referred to as a near peer, right? So someone who might be a friend or an acquaintance, someone with similar resources, maybe similar abilities, and how we view their posts, whether it's an image of their body or what they're wearing or something related to workout or a, you know, an athletic accomplishment, that might be sort of interpreted differently than if we see someone that we sort of aspire to be. So someone that might be sort of put up on a pedestal in, you know, really a high level of achievement, whether it's related to the body or activity. And unfortunately, some of the things we see that might be more negative in terms of impacting people are unrealistic and, you know, sort of unattainable body shapes and physiques and messages that might promote disordered or dysfunctional eating and activity, and that can be quite concerning.
Talking to Christy Greenleaf, kinesiology professor at UW-Milwaukee, looking at how social media and fitness apps have changed the exercise game for better in some ways and for worse in others. And Christy, we know in politics and other realms of life, not everything we see on social media is true. Is there a lot of bad fitness information out there when we when our friends share things on Facebook and other sources?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, and I think, you know, consumers have to be sort of critical in how they are interpreting the messages and maybe do a little bit of homework in terms of who is really providing advice and recommendations in terms of what kinds of qualifications and education and training the individual might have. There certainly is, you know, a complex science behind the body in terms of physical activity, in terms of energy balance, in terms of nutrition, and people spend a lot of years really studying and trying to understand those complexities. And I think sometimes what we see is that the messages are very oversimplified, and the simplified message then is assumed to lead to some kind of dramatic change in weight or physique that's really pretty unrealistic.
I'm also wondering, too, one thing that feels like it's different in the social media era is that we've almost gamified fitness in a way versus it used to be if you wanted to lose weight, oftentimes you were doing it because you just wanted to do it. But now it seems like, Rob, I know you wore a Fitbit for a little bit, and I know we've had other people here who have done that, and it seems like there's these mini competitions mm-hmm. that kind of break out, like, I bet I can get more steps than you. And I'm wondering if this idea of gamifying fitness has changed this whole equation for better or worse.
Yeah, that's a really interesting concept that seems to be more and more popular, even in educational settings, using this gamification approach. And I think one of the challenges is we live in a world where physical activity and eating that is healthful oftentimes are the hard choices to make. It's easy to be sedentary. It's easy to eat, you know, foods that may not really contribute to good health. And so I think the gamification approach is at least one strategy to try to make, you know, moving your body and eating in a nutritious way more enjoyable and pleasurable. And there is, you know, some potential benefit to having a social component. So feeling, you know, accountable to others in some form or fashion, whether it's through a competition or some kind of interactive, you know, environment can be beneficial. There's always the other side of things, though, where some individuals may, you know, in a competitive environment, take things to the extreme where they start engaging in behaviors that really are not, you know, supporting their health. And, for example, I sometimes worry about when I see in workplaces these weight loss competitions because generally those types of activities don't lead to sustainable health behavior change, and rather people engage in you know, dramatic short-term behaviors to try to win some, you know, prize or reward.
We're talking right now with Christy Greenleaf. She is a kinesiology professor in the Exercise and Health Promotion Unit at UW-Milwaukee. She's also co-director of UWM's Body Weight and Shape Research Lab.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried a fitness app of one sort or another for an exercise plan, tracking your exercise? What was your experience like? Do you think it helped? Do you share a lot of fitness-related information on social media? Do your friends? Do you like it when they do? Does it inspire you or discourage you? You can call in at 800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Chris Molina. Right now, we continue the conversation with Christy Greenleaf. We're talking about exercise and fitness culture on our phones and online, from apps to Instagram influencers. Christy is a kinesiology professor at UW-Milwaukee and the co-director of the Body Weight and Shape Research Lab.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have things like fitness apps, social media, or the internet in general change the way you think about exercise and fitness? Want to hear your experiences? And are you tired of seeing other people, maybe on your social media feeds, posting about their trips to the gym or their before and after pictures? Do you enjoy reading and even sharing your own fitness tips? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And Christy, on one hand, it feels like maybe we're in this golden age of fitness where regardless of what kind of activity you're interested in doing, there's a community out there for you. There are resources. But we should talk a little bit about what is available to people in terms of what you're seeing on social media and the internet and technology. What's available right now for people who are looking to get in shape?
Sure. I think, you know, as we mentioned earlier, the social media that we see, and it's currently, you know, continuing to advance and change. And I think as our sort of social systems change, it will continue to adapt. There are a lot of adaptations around sort of individualized prescriptions for physical activity that I think are of interest to people, where you might not need to have physical proximity, but through technology, you know, you can have interactions with health coaches or wellness coaches, personal trainers, et cetera. But then I also think one of the things I've seen recently that's sort of intriguing are the Peloton bikes and the mirror systems, where you have, you know, a reflection of yourself, but then also a personal trainer giving you real-time feedback. And I think as technology advances, we're going to see more and more of that, where there's some sort of maybe virtual kind of coaching going on that is interactive and is occurring in real time. I think what we see right now is a lot of folks take advantage of social media groups, whether they're organized meetups for, you know, folks that have a common interest in biking or hiking. We see a lot of opportunities through Facebook as well, and Facebook events for people to who share a common, you know, interest or passion related to activity or even food and eating, to get together. And I think, again, that gives some opportunity for folks to get together in person, but also to kind of provide shared interest and support online and through electronic means.
Let's bring on a caller now. Sonia is with us in Madison. Sonia, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Oh, I was going to say I have used a few apps for running, and MapMyRun was my first one I used. I ended up having problems with it, so I now use Nike running apps. But I really liked them in tracking my distance and time, and it will chime in with, like, how quick the timing of your splits. And I really liked them. And, like, a few times I did a cool route that it just turned out really neat on a map. So I was able to, you know, take a screenshot of it and just send it by text message to a few people. But otherwise, I didn't ever put any of it on social media, just because I wanted to keep my routes private just for safety.
Sonia, thank you so much for that call. And Sonia brought up a couple of points, talked about, you know, some of the sharing aspects and whatnot. She also referenced some technology that didn't work so well for her. And I'm wondering, Christy, if there's any research out there about when a device or a service doesn't work the way we hope it works, if that causes people to just give up on that activity.
That's a great question. I haven't seen anything come out in the literature that would be quite fascinating to study, though, in terms of maybe not even if it doesn't work, but the difficulty of usage or how user-friendly the app is. That often does relate to the speed at which people adopt new technology, for example. But I haven't seen anything on the other end in terms of discontinuing usage because of, you know, difficulties or challenges with the technology itself, although that would make sense.
Sonia, thanks for the call. We'll go now to Stan in Waukesha. Stan, hello.
Hey, how are you?
Good. What's your story, Stan?
So, yeah, I've kind of been burned a little bit by actually the social aspects of fitness apps. I've used several different ones, including one focused more on weight training, and then I've used, you know, the Fitbit app. And I was actually part of a challenge at one point, although in my case it was about weight gain, so not necessarily about weight loss. And what it ended up doing is kind of making me gain weight in a shorter time using a lot of shortcuts that eventually led me to get something called non-alcoholic fatty liver. So after that, actually, I started doing a little bit more research about, you know, sort of gamification in general, and worked on locking down my device. So I, you know, I turned off all of the notifications that such apps give me, all of these like social sharing elements, including the little, I forget what they call them, but you know, when an app shows you a little circle that you have, you know, say two unread things or challenges
like
or whatever.
The notifications.
Turned those off. Yeah, I turned those off as well. So essentially I started using them really as just a way to track my exercise and sort of set goals just for myself and not be part of any network.
Interesting, Stan. Thanks a lot for the call. Christy, there, what you were mentioning earlier, actually, gamification and challenges might lead us to extreme behavior, taking it too far, maybe past a healthy direction.
Yeah, that can certainly happen. You know, people wanting to get that positive feedback and those rewards, whether it's through the app itself or, you know, other types of social reinforcement they might receive, sometimes folks end up engaging in behaviors that might help them accomplish the goal, but maybe not in the healthiest of ways or in ways that are really sustainable. And in the end, that's really the key, is what can people maintain throughout their lives that is going to support good health? And oftentimes that's engaging in activity and eating in a way that kind of has to do with moderation, which isn't always super exciting. But in terms of health promotion, that's often the kind of best strategy.
We're talking with Christy Greenleaf. She's a professor in the Exercise Science and Health Promotion Unit at UW-Milwaukee, talking about fitness culture in the 21st century, apps, social media, technology, you name it. And Christy, one thing I'm wondering about, we've seen somewhat of a shift society-wide recently in terms of the way we talk about this in the first place. It seems like organizations, you know, in the last couple of decades have really pushed weight loss. Now we're seeing more of a shift towards talk over wellness. Well-known, perhaps, was the organization formerly known as Weight Watchers, now just known as WW, talking more and emphasizing more this idea of wellness. And I'm curious if you think that this culture, fueled by some of these apps, some of these new services, has really changed the way we talk about health and fitness in general.
Yeah, I think that at least what I've seen recently is that the terminology might change, and I think you're right, the language might change, but I think the underlying pieces are still the same. So it might not be called Weight Watchers anymore, but the intent of the program is to promote weight loss just within a framework of wellness. And one of the things that's challenging is, as our sort of science improves and technology improves in terms of understanding the complexities of weight and weight maintenance, is that a lot of what we know is actually pretty inaccurate. So, you know, it used to be that people believed if you could, either through caloric restriction or increased energy expenditure, burn 3,500 calories, that would equate to a pound of weight loss. And we now know that that's not actually the case and that it's much more complicated than that. There's a huge amount of individual variation. And so I think because weight loss and maintenance of weight loss is so difficult because our bodies fight against it in a whole host of ways, that some organizations have moved away from explicitly talking about weight loss because it's actually pretty ineffective. The programs are pretty ineffective, and so it's just been repackaged in this wellness kind of framework, which wellness is multifaceted and includes, you know, psychological and social, economic, spiritual aspects along with physical aspects. So one of my concerns would be that there's maybe lip service paid to wellness, but it might just be a reframed or repackaged dieting approach. And we know that there are lots of negative consequences with dieting.
Well, Christy, you've mentioned a couple times that as opposed to I'm going to do something big this month, the bigger win is if we can establish more healthy habits that we keep into the future. Can you give us a couple tips on how to do that, on how to make maybe a little change or two that we're going to stick with?
Sure. I think having a good assessment of what resources you have easily available to you. So you could think about doing an environmental scan for yourself. What things do you have in your neighborhood that are easily accessible, maybe at your workplace or in your school? You might think about, you know, what kinds of things already go on within your family that maybe you could just build upon. So sort of starting from a place of strength, what resources do you already have that you could build upon to make incremental changes toward, you know, having as part of your normal day activities that benefit your health. So it could be things related to your family, building in walks or bike rides, you know, before or after a meal or on the weekends. At work, it might be thinking about, you know, can you have a walking meeting instead of sitting at a desk? Would it be possible to walk up and down the stairs at your building or go for a walk outside when the weather is more conducive? So I think it's really, you know, a bit dependent on the person and their situation, but if there are ways in which you can build upon things that you already have sort of structured in your life, that is often an effective strategy.
Christy, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciated hearing from your callers and great questions today.
That's Christy Greenleaf, professor in the Exercise Science and Health Promotion Unit at UW-Milwaukee, also co-director of UWM's Bodyweight and Shape Research Lab. Joining us to talk about how apps and social media have shaped fitness culture. Time to come back to the walking meeting, Chris.
The walking, we went on one walking meeting in the early days of Central Time. It was really hot. We would not have that problem right now. I think it would be a little too icy, but we will revisit that idea.
You were the only person who didn't complain about it. Thank you for that.
I remember that very well. Well, coming up after the news, we'll find out why so many teacher strikes have happened in the last year. Just this year alone, we've seen strikes in West Virginia, California, and maybe more. We'll find out what's behind them. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Chris Molina.
And I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, some communities in northwestern Wisconsin are coming together to tackle their affordable housing shortages. We'll talk to the head of a local economic development organization about what they hope this partnership is going to accomplish.
First, a growing wave of teacher strikes appears to be gaining momentum in the United States. This year alone, teacher strikes have taken place in California, Denver, and West Virginia. And some believe more could be coming soon.
Teacher frustration is nothing new, but why are so many of these strikes and protests happening now?
Paul Revel is a professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, gentlemen.
So we've seen teacher strikes all around the country, some statewide, some limited to certain districts. Of course, each one of these is unique, but are there issues or policies that are common to a lot of these strikes?
Well, I think the most common issue is the level of funding in education as it translates to teacher compensation. This is certainly where some of these strikes had their origins, for example, the original strike in West Virginia last year, where over the years, state governments in particular, local governments, have been cutting back on their capacity to finance schools. That translates, schools' budgets are 80% people typically, so that translates into frozen or declining salaries and benefits for teachers. And given the fact that the overall economy is surging and social media has the capacity to connect teachers, I think a number of teachers, particularly in the states that have been most unfriendly to teacher organizing in the early stages, decided to come together and say enough is enough. We've had enough. We're fed up. We won't take it anymore. And we need to be able to make a decent living as a teacher. You had teachers working two and three jobs to support a family, teachers on food stamps in order to feed their family, things of this nature that had just gotten intolerable. And I think once one or two of these strikes was successful, it sort of lit a brush fire and gave confidence to teachers in other places that the time had come to push harder.
It seems like strikes and walkouts by their nature are sort of motivated by lower pay, maybe not so great working conditions. And as you said, we've seen that with these initial teacher protests. And I'm curious how that's evolved over the past year or so, because now it seems like we're seeing some protests that are more aimed towards policy. Can you talk about that evolution that we've seen?
Well, the strikes have shifted from coming in states where the level of teacher organization and labor laws were such that teachers' unions did not have much power, or, as in West Virginia, the teacher salaries were negotiated at a state level. Now it's moving in. For example, in Los Angeles, you're in a district where, comparatively speaking, salaries are relatively high because the cost of living is high there. There's still financial issues in that strike, and those financial issues got settled in favor of the teachers. But there are a host of other issues on top of finances that, again, I think, given the rising confidence of teachers that they can have impact in the current political climate, have been pushed to the fore. So charter schools were on the list of concerns that were raised there. In Denver, it's not so much the amount of compensation, although that factors in. It's the way in which teachers are being paid. In other areas, it's matters of class size and things of that nature that have historically been included in contracts, but in some places have not been included in contracts and therefore become subject to focus in some of the strikes.
We're talking with Paul Revel right now. He is a professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. We are talking about teacher strikes in California, in West Virginia, looking at what spawned this movement and potentially what's ahead. And Paul, these teachers that have walked out, whether it be in West Virginia or California, have these protests largely been successful in favor of the teachers? Have they been getting what they've been asking for?
Yeah, you'd have to say for the most part they have been. The teachers have been successful. I mean, they were successful last year in West Virginia, and they're back at it again this year. Some hostile legislation was introduced, and the teachers felt compelled to rise up. And even as part of the hostile legislation, there was some teacher raise money included, but the teachers were sufficiently upset about other provisions of that legislation that they rose up. So I think that success is breeding more activity here, and that the initial strikes have been successful. I mean, the general public values teachers, and voters and taxpayers tend to be sympathetic to teachers. And when these strikes bring to the forefront some of the realities of teacher pay and teacher working conditions, the general public tends to be sympathetic, and therefore legislators or policymakers or school board members feel compelled to make some movement where before, when this wasn't so much on the public's agenda or in the public's view, they could get away with not doing much.
I'm also wondering, too, we've heard stories recently. I know here in Wisconsin, the state has been dealing with somewhat of a teacher shortage, and some people think that some of that comes from maybe compensation. Some believe it comes from the way that teachers have been regarded by politicians and some of the policies that has been enacted. And so, some believe that this teacher shortage has emerged out of that. And I'm wondering if things like these strikes perhaps might be motivating for those considering education as a possible career.
Well, I think, the elements that you mentioned are certainly factors. We're not making teaching a very attractive profession when you have to work two jobs and get on food stamps in order to support your family in order to be a teacher. And teachers are regularly giving up their own money in order to support, students and activities that they'd like to do in the classroom. We don't generally, compared with other societies, hold teachers in very high esteem in terms of the status and prestige that we give them in our society. The demographics are tapering off in terms of people going to college and therefore graduating from college. We're in something close to a full employment economy in a lot of places around the country. So we are looking at shortages. We're looking at a lot of people retiring in the field of teaching and not that many people lining up to come back into the profession. And that should give cause for concern to all of us, because obviously education is a vital function. And in fact, part of the reason that we have this whole movement going is that we've taken education for granted for a long time. And in many of our states, we've decided that economic development incentives to companies and things of that nature are more important. I know you have some experience with this in Wisconsin, are more important than investing in our human resource, human capital development system called education. So we've provided a lot of tax breaks. We've kept taxes down. And the chief victim of that strategy have been public schools and the children they serve, because those budgets have been flat or declining in many states over time. And this has resulted in teachers being shortchanged. And now they're rising up and saying, we can't take it anymore.
Has there been any significant pushback to these protests? I know you said that teachers and their demands for better pay, better conditions seem to play well with the public. But have we seen any kind of pushback in terms of the public or with politicians as well?
Not really. I mean, people are worried about their budgets, their state budgets. So people who are conservative about how much can we commit from the budget, we've been trying to hold the tax rate down. Where are we going to get the revenues to pay the teachers the additional money? You don't have many people lining up and saying, you know, you're already paid enough. That's fine. You'll be fine. But it's more, can we afford this? It would be great to do it. So the pushback more manifests, at least in the early stages here, about issues of affordability, whether or not the raises can be afforded. When it comes to some other areas, for example, in Los Angeles, you have the charter school issues. So you have, you know, virtually a civil war within the education sector over charter schools. So there are people in favor of choice and people opposed to choice, and you have also a lot of experience of that set of battles in Wisconsin, I know. And so those kinds of issues will surface as forms of pushback. You will get pushback over issues like class size, because the research on class size does not always indicate that smaller class sizes are necessarily better. It really depends on what size you're talking about and what age and what are the description of the students involved. So, but on the whole, the public reception to these strikes has been very sympathetic, and in consequence of that, policymakers have basically been acceding to the requests.
And briefly, Paul, as we start to wrap up, where do you see this movement going in the next year or so?
Well, I think teachers are feeling their muscle, and to the degree that they're being successful in the field, I fully expect to see more strikes or more labor actions. In other words, more pressure on local officials to raise local revenues and state officials to raise state revenues. I would hope that we see a restoration of education and education funding as a prominent public issue in some of the campaigns in the future. If you look at the last presidential campaign, there was virtually no mention of K-12 education, very seldom mentioned by either candidate from either party. And I think education is coming back onto the public agenda, and the most prominent manifestation of this, at least in the short term, may be these teacher strikes.
Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me with you.
Paul Revel is a professor of practice of educational policy and administration at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. He was with us to talk about some of the high-profile teacher strikes we've seen across the country.
Coming up next, we'll talk about affordable housing needs in rural Wisconsin and how communities are tackling that problem. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. Stay with us here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, we'll take a look at the history of black farmers and food justice movements from the Mississippi Delta to Milwaukee.
First, affordable housing is often seen as a big city problem, but rural areas and small towns in northwestern Wisconsin are also feeling the pinch.
A group of six communities in Barron County has decided to try a new approach by joining forces across their different towns and villages to tackle the problem.
Dave Armstrong is the executive director of the Barron County Economic Development Corporation. Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Sure, no problem.
Well, tell us about this problem. There's not enough affordable housing in parts of northwestern Wisconsin. What's going on up there?
Well, as you look throughout the country, people are aging in place longer, better health care, longer life rates. Just because they're aging in place just doesn't mean that they're necessarily keeping up the houses like they used to. So as our folks age in place, the housing stock ages. that specifically what brought this up originally was when we started looking at workforce issues. I've got about 600 open jobs throughout the county right now, and that's in a county of roughly 46,000. So we looked at, all right, how do we approach the housing or the workforce side of it? Immediately we looked at, we need more housing. So that's pretty much originally what started the whole piece. You look at a few of the smaller communities, Barron, Cumberland, some of them haven't built a new apartment building in 20, 30 years. So it's an acute need.
So the worry there is, if you want to bring in workers to fill these positions, where are they going to live? If there's not an apartment or a house they can afford, there's no way to make them move to the community, right?
Oh, exactly. And even getting some of the graduates that have gone away, gone off to college, come back, they want to start a family, live here. Again, you know, where are they going to go? So, yes, absolutely.
Okay, so the demand is there. People might be thinking, so why wouldn't a developer just show up and say, hey, yeah, I'll build houses or apartments to meet this demand?
It's kind of a twofold problem there. Is the demand is there. When we started talking with developers, we've got to prove the demand is there. And so that's what originally had launched a countywide housing study. We had brought last year five of the state agencies up here for meetings with four of the communities to talk about overall needs in each community, some business needs, housing needs. And out of that, the Department of Administration said, well, WEDA, Wisconsin Housing Economic Development Authority, originally said, you know, to get some of the investment dollars, we've got to prove a need, so we're going to need this housing study. Well, DOA came in and said, because the housing you're looking for is workforce housing, low and moderate income, we'll pay for half of that with a grant. So that's what kind of kick-started this. So we've got, again, twofold. We're going through the housing study right now, and then once that's done, then the developers had said, you know, we want to see some masses of housing to be able to compete with the major metro areas. And so that was kind of the discussion with all the communities. Let's, you know, kind of band together here. Each community gets 30, 40 units, and all of a sudden we've got, you know, a couple hundred units.
Right, because that's a big part of the challenge you're dealing with, as I understand it. If I'm a developer in, I don't know, suburban Milwaukee area, outlying Dane County, I can build 200 buildings in one development. That is not something you're looking for, say, in Barron County, right?
No, exactly. I mean, that's the economies of scale that they're used to. And so what we took the approach of is, we can give you 200 of those units in a 30-mile radius with no permitting issues, no roadblocks. Would that be of interest? And we're hearing from developers that, yes, it would.
Talking to Dave Armstrong, Executive Director of the Barron County Economic Development Corporation, looking at problems with a shortage of affordable housing in Barron County, also going on elsewhere in northwestern Wisconsin. Dave, talk a little more about how these multiple communities have gotten together. You talked about, okay, we're going to divvy up that demand to try to bring these developers. What did it take to get the communities cooperating and working together like this?
It was actually a lot easier than what I thought it would be. When we went in, just with the listening, what are you looking for right now? Typically, we would go to the mayors or the clerk treasurers, say, what are you looking for now? What's a need out there? And all of them would, you know, give the conversations they're having inside, and that's when it started building to is, you know, we've got to work for a housing issue throughout, and it's not necessarily your single-family low to moderate incomes. It's senior housing, it's transitional housing for the homeless or those coming out of chemical dependency. So it was a wide variety of housing needs.
So what is the timeline now with communities working together and hoping to have developers start developing?
Right now, we're about midway through the housing study. The first piece of it is we went to UW River Falls, their survey center, and they designed an employee survey. So we've reached out to 67 businesses throughout the county because we need about 3,000 questionnaires from employees because we want to know what kind of housing do you want, what's not out there. All right. And so once we get that done, and we've had some interesting information, you know, come back so far, is what we're finding the sweet spot. Again, this is rural Wisconsin. So sweet spot here is your $100,000 to $140,000, $150,000 homes. One of our communities, Rice Lake, we pulled their numbers, and their new housing starts a year previous averaged 244. So all of a sudden we're seeing, wait a minute now, our needs are 140, 150 and below, and they're building 244, so we've got issues we've got to work through, too, as far as affordability goes.
Is that developers building for vacation homes? What's going on there?
No, this was single. That's a single-family home in Rice Lake. To me, it's more engineer housing, not your workforce housing.
What are you hearing from business owners as you go through this process about how much of a roadblock this is for them?
All of them, regardless of who we talk to, saying, you know, guys, it's hard recruiting if we don't have housing to recruit people. They've even said the same thing. Talked to one manufacturer in Cumberland, said, you know, it's hard even getting engineers to come here because of the lack in that community of those medium to little more expensive homes. So, no, we're hearing it across the board, be it, you know, the starter, new workforce, you know, new worker, all the way up to the engineers.
And when I've talked to people from smaller communities a couple times, I've heard the problem, we're not keeping young people in the community. They're moving to larger communities elsewhere because they don't have jobs usually. Maybe it's housing too. How much of this is keeping people in the community? How much of it is bringing people into work in these communities?
Oh, quite a bit. I mean, one of the issues that we've got, challenges, are some of the what they have in the bigger cities as far as, you know, things for families, et cetera, et cetera. So the amenities. So what we ended up doing 2 years ago is we introduced placemaking to three of the cities across the county, and it couldn't have gone better. And the whole idea behind placemaking is determine areas within the community that people congregate, and then you do studies and volunteer. It's all volunteer-driven of, all right, what can we do in those areas to make them places people can't wait to get and don't want to leave, as opposed to the opposite. So, you know, you've got, well, I guess, a multi-layered approach here is we're making cooler communities, more amenities. We're trying to get the families that have gone, or the students that have gone away, start a family, come back. And it's worked in a number of cases. We've had some wins. And then also trying to give the students that are staying here better training through the youth apprenticeship, to registered apprenticeship, and just marrying them up with the businesses to get a better trained workforce right from the get-go.
Now, you mentioned state grants and I think tax credits earlier. What kind of help are you getting and hoping to get at the state level?
WEDA, there again, Wisconsin Housing Economic Development Authority, is playing a key role there. They've got the tax credits in place for the developers to help build. Rice Lake, for example, is an opportunity community with a new opportunity zone, so that gives other incentives to, you know, available. We're using new market tax credits in some cases, so we're using a variety of programs that can be layered on each other.
In our last minute or so, paint me a picture of a win in 10 years or so, Dave. If everything goes right, what are you hoping to see there?
A win in 10 years is going to be those communities that have participated, and frankly a few others, much less reliant on trying to attract people from elsewhere because they've come. They've got a vibrant communities. I hear less from the manufacturers, or actually all employers, healthcare specifically, that I can't get people to live here. Basically, it's that we've got a thriving little small community, low crime, great schools, et cetera, that people want to live in.
And briefly again, Dave, what's the next step right now?
The next step, finishing off this housing study, and then once we know the type housing and the numbers we need in the areas, is going to the developers.
Dave, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You bet. Thank you much.
We've been talking to Dave Armstrong, Executive Director of the Barron County Economic Development Corporation. He joined us to talk about a partnership with six of the communities in the county trying to tackle their affordable housing problem. I'd be interested to hear from you if you are in northwestern Wisconsin yourself. Barron County, we've been talking about. This is an issue going on in neighboring counties as well. Have you had trouble finding a house you can afford if you're working in that area? If you are an employer, as Dave was talking about, is this a roadblock, an obstacle for getting employees, potential employees, from moving to the community and working for you? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at @CentralTimeWPR. As we've been hearing, when it comes to finding the right person to fill a job, companies can have a difficult time. But one big company recently struck gold with their announcement of their new president.
Yeah, last week, the president of Nintendo of America announced he'd be stepping down from his position later this year. His replacement? Well, a guy called Doug Bowser. Yep, that's right. Bowser, as in Mario's main bad guy for the past 3 decades or so.
So this is like if the Star Wars franchise hired Steve Vader to run the operations or Bob Voldemort took over Harry Potter merchandising.
Exactly. It's really kind of perfect. And I think, you know, Nintendo should really just lean into this at this point. I mean, you've got like the main bad guy. I'm sure this is a very nice guy who's
Maybe.
Running this company.
Who
but,
can say?
You know, exactly. So I think they should totally play it up and, you know, really have some fun with it because... When do you get an opportunity like this?
I've played various Mario games over the years, Chris. I believe you've played a lot more than I have.
I probably have played a few more. I kind of grew up with it. I never usually get to Bowser. Not that good.
That's the thing. I don't have the patience to get to the big boss level.
Exactly. You usually get a couple of levels in, and it's like, all right, time to do something else. But
can you play Bowser in that Mario Kart game?
Was
that an option?
I do believe you can, uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay, that's the sweet. That's the quick and easy way. If you want to pretend you are the president of Nintendo, Mario Kart is the way to play Bowser.
Just pick Bowser the next time you play Mario Kart. That's the solution.
Ooh, maybe they're going to make him like really like a better Mario Karter now that Bowser's the boss.
They're going to make him work for this, yeah.
Definitely. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.